The WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service, partly sunny today, a high of 88, some 20 degrees warmer than normal for this time of year. Could see some light showers and storms during the afternoon hours. Then for tonight, a lingering chance of some light showers. Cooler air moving in, a low of 55. Then for tomorrow, as the weather pattern changes, a high of just 68, partly sunny in the morning, then clearing skies the rest of the day. Expanded forecast continue dry through the weekend, with temperatures primarily in the 60s. Right now, we've got mostly sunny skies, a temperature reading of 65. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. And on today's Morning Show, we're talking about libraries, and specifically the Kenosha Public Library System, and what a jewel it has been, what an important part of our community all these many years, and a vibrant part of our community even in these changing times when the whole notion of what a library is or what it has to offer has changed so dramatically. And I've always been impressed in all of my years here in Kenosha with how vibrant the library system is, and the capable leadership that has allowed it to continue to flourish and be a central player in people's lives, people of all ages. On today's program, we have in the studios Barbara Bratton, who is the director of the Kenosha Public Library System, and also Angie Aker, who is vice president of the Kenosha Public Library Foundation. They have a very special event that is coming up on Saturday evening, the 7th of October, a special event which honors the long legacy of Howard and Betsy Brown, who have, of course, done such good work over the years. And, of course, sadly, Howard Brown is no longer with us, but Betsy Brown very much still is, and will be on hand for this special event, honoring her and helping to sustain the work of the Kenosha Public Library Foundation. So we certainly want to talk about that, but beyond that event, we want to talk about the ongoing good work of the Kenosha Public Library and the foundation that supports all that it does. Barbara Bratton, Angie Aker, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good to have both of you here. I'm glad we can have this conversation. Angie, let's actually, right off the bat, talk about this special event which is coming up, which supports the Kenosha Public Library Foundation. Maybe let's begin with that, with what the Kenosha Public Library Foundation does. Can we assume from the name that it operates the way a lot of similarly named groups do?
Absolutely. We are a support foundation. You know, we look for opportunities to be able to jump in and provide the funding and the monetary support whenever something is needed in the library. There are, you know, many great benefactors who have very specific funds for specific types of needs. And so what we like to do is stay in contact with Barb and the library system, find out where those needs are, and find out which of those funds can best match those when those come up.
Very good. So this big event coming up on Saturday, October 7th, is this something that happens on a fairly regular basis?
This is our first time ever putting together this event, and it has been a lot of work and a lot of exciting, challenging times to put this together. Putting together a gala is no small feat.
Right.
And so So we've been busy. And what we realized that the community doesn't necessarily know what the foundation does or how it interacts with the library system itself. And we thought this was a really great way to try to get the public more involved with the foundation and the library, to tell the story of our supporters like Howard and Betsy Brown and what they've given to the community and to the library. And we thought it would be really great to have this really enjoyable, spectacular evening with people.
Fantastic. And we'll before we're done, we'll find out more about what's on tap and also talk a little bit more about what prompted you to select Howard and Betsy Brown as, in a sense, the honorees of this first gala. So we'll look forward to talking about that. Barbara Bratton, you came to Kenosha 3.5 years ago, and we had a conversation, I think, not too long ago, on the not too long after that, after you came to town as the new director of the Kenosha Public Library System. I don't remember the story ahead of that. Are you one of these people who's been a lifelong lover of books and pretty much a lifelong librarian?
Yeah, that's been my calling and my passion, and I've done that in 4 different states, and I've landed in the best one now, so here I am.
Very good. So tell us about sort of your earliest love affair with books and with reading. I mean, what can you tell us about sort of the initial spark of all that?
I had very literate parents. I'm sure that was part of it. They were German immigrants, and education was the most important thing for them to instill in us. It was a very quiet household, and you know, so we had a lot of books around. And in first grade, I remember being pulled out of my classroom, and my teacher asked me to write books instead of being in class. Because I was so far ahead with such a literate household and a very very smart sister who used to teach me everything, who was 2 years ahead of me. So I was kind of 2 years ahead. And I had a very smart teacher who knew I was going to be bored and withdraw if I didn't do something different. So she asked me to just, you know, write little books. And so that, I guess that was my super connection. From then on, I was hooked. Stories. You know, it's all about stories.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So at what point did it become clear to you that you were going to become a librarian?
I was a history major in college. I'd started out as a science major. And then I ran into, as we can all, I'm sure, have a story like this, that one professor who just shocked you. You know, I wasn't interested in taking anything but science classes, but I had to. And that he was such a storyteller, back to the stories, that he turned everything into this incredible story that really, it put everything into perspective, you know, the past, the present, why is the present the way that it is? So I was captivated by that. And I remember going up to him after class and saying, what can you do with a history major? So I like to tell the story of classes, we had to go to the bowels of the library, to the very bottom, to the dark recesses and into the archives. And I was just totally hooked after that. So, I said, then I started asking a question, what can you do with the library degree? Or how do you work in libraries? And so the rest is history.
Wow. So you shifted over to library science then? That became your major?
I finished the history major. The library degree is a master's degree.
Okay. And so you began doing this work then. Did being a librarian live up to what you sort of thought it would be? I mean, sometimes when people become things for which they've had sort of long-time dreams, they don't necessarily know what it really means to be a dentist or be an astronaut or be a librarian.
Well, I think the library profession is so varied. There's so many things you can do. And now with the information so computerized, it's even broader than it's ever been. So you have so many different opportunities. It's the perfect profession for someone who's interested in everything. If you're just so curious that almost anything interests you, it's the perfect profession. Mm. There are some people who, you know, find one thing that they're very passionate about, and they're going to learn everything about that. And then there's other people who just want to know everything about everything, and so that's perfect for librarians. Mm. Yeah.
So when you took the position here in Kenosha, had you had a position like that before, or did this mark any kind of professional progression or a step into a different direction for you?
It's definitely a progression. I was a library director in Colorado, but it was one library, and now we have four. So it's a bigger job than before. And something that some people might not know is that there's also something called a library system that's different. Most people call a multi-branch library system. But there is in Wisconsin that has a different connotation. That is a different entity that is supported by state and county dollars to provide equal technology to all the libraries in the area. So for us at Kenosha Public Library, that's a city library, and it has funding from tax dollars from the city. But the county and the state provide money to Kenosha County Library System, again, which provides all that technology support, and we just happen to also run that.
Okay. So I should be careful not to call it the Kenosha Public Library System for the point of clarity in some
just
ways.
Just in Wisconsin.
Right.
If you were sitting in Illinois, that would make sense.
That would be okay. All right. Well, at any rate, yes, we're talking about four different libraries that comprise the Kenosha Public Library.
It's that's right.
More than one library. I remember that I live in Racine now, but I when I started this job back in 1986, I lived in Kenosha and used the Kenosha Public Libraries all the time. So a couple of these questions are because I don't interact as regularly as I once did. I remember that once upon a time, each of the four public libraries each had their own particular focus. Is that still the way it is, or now are they, or is what they provide now in a sense more evenly distributed amongst them? Do they not each have their own sort of special sort of focus and purpose?
It's a very interesting question, because in the library profession, we go back and forth and back and forth about should everything be at every branch, because then that's equal service, versus there's something special about this neighborhood, and shouldn't we respond to that? So basically what we do is we do some pretty core things. So you can get just about everything you want at every branch. But yes, in fact, we're actually taking a harder look at Uptown right now. Who's in that neighborhood, and what would they be most interested in? So we're getting, libraries are kind of run like businesses more than they used to be. So we really look at marketing, segmentation, and that kind of thing. Like, you know, who's in that neighborhood? What are they using at that library? And let's beef that up. So it's kind of a hybrid answer to your question.
Mm-hmm. I remember interviewing Doug Baker. Was he your predecessor?
Yeah
I thought so. We spoke several times over the period of his long tenure as director of Kenosha Public Library, but I most memorably remember our conversation about when, I believe it was, the extensive renovation of the Southwest Library, which necessitated the moving of these thousands of books into this sort of alternate site, and keeping them all in order and then safeguarding their safe return to the shelves and so on. I just thought, what a nightmarish project in terms of sheer complexity. I suppose that's the kind of thing that's a very sobering part of the job, but I don't think you've had to deal with that, any sort of wholesale moving of all of this. But it really underscored for me something that we kind of all know and yet don't maybe deeply appreciate: the complexity of a library in terms of all that is housed within its walls, and what it means to keep all of that straight and to make all the decisions that have to be made about what's most important for us to have and what things do we at some point need to sort of let slip away. I'm almost haunted by that conversation, because I think it's for the first time, even for someone who's in libraries all the time, for all my life, I don't think I'd ever stop to really appreciate just how complicated an organism a library is.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's fun, you know? It's fun to make it all work and then try something different, see if that works. And it's so wonderful to work with a public who is open to that, trying new things and seeing what else we can do. And it's an interactive kind of business. You interact with your public, and like, what kind of form do you want that human story in now? Because this human story is not going away. We need that. So, but is it in print now? And you can see how people's attitudes change too. The whole thing about, oh, print's going away. Well, you know, we all kind of chuckled to ourselves and say, well, we'll see how long this lasts. And now it's evened out. You know, I mean, there was this huge surge in ebooks, and now at, you know, print and ebook are even. And that's it. And it's not moving.
Right.
It's not changing. So we'll see how the what the future looks like. But it's just, you know, we've seen a lot of change. And we're reorganizing ourselves to figure out how to remain relevant, because we know how important we are.
Right. So in the matter of books, physical books that are on the shelf, which, of course, once upon a time was, I mean, it felt like the by far the main reason a library existed was that's the building you go to check out a book off of the shelf and bring it home and then bring it back. And that's what it was all about, even in the days when there were other reasons actually to go to the library. But most of us, that's what we think of first and foremost. To what extent has that changed, for instance, for the Kenosha Public Library in terms of physical books, the number of books on the shelves, and that being sort of the focus of why you exist and what you do and what you offer the community? Has that slipped from the spotlight in any respect, or slipped down the scale of priorities?
Well, it's a good point that you bring up. That has remained the core. It has remained the core. And it's because of the specialty that we bring to it, the reader's advisory, we call it. It's like, what do you want to read next? You can go out on Amazon and see what other people like bought, but you know, who's going to tell you, well, if you really like that particular kind of character in that particular kind of setting in that particular period of time, you'd really like this. There is that human nuance to it that we're very, very good at. And keeping kids engaged, you know, giving them that head start. Those are the things that have always been the core for us. But as information changes in how it's delivered and how we access it, that's really almost laid on some layers, extra layers to what we do. So we've gotten bigger and more powerful. Teaching people, digital literacy is a big thing, teaching people how to get to that information. I think it's the challenge for all of us. It's always a new device. It's, you know, different format, and how they all have their shortcomings. And so you just, you know, have to continue to learn all the time. And where are you going to do that? With us, you know, especially around Christmas time when people get new devices.
You're the place to go.
We actually have things called tech guides where you can call in and make an appointment and say, I just can't figure out this iPhone, or would you help me, you know, with this Google Docs or something?
Wow.
And we'll sit down with you for 30 minutes and do you one-on-one instruction. But see that how we morphed into so much more. You know, we really are like information guides.
For those of you just joining us, I have in the studios today Barbara Bratton, who is director of the Kenosha Public Library, and also with us is Angie Aker, vice president of the Kenosha Public Library Foundation. What prompts this particular conversation is a big event coming up for the foundation on Saturday, October 7th, and we'll be talking about that in just a little bit. So Barbara Bratton, let's remain for a moment with the matter of books. What guides the choices that the library makes in terms of what new books to secure for its collection? And also what guides you in terms of when it's time to let a book go, when it does not need to be on the shelf anymore? Who makes those decisions and how?
The library profession is very supportive of each other. And so what we do is review books. Let's face it, we've got New York Times review books and, you know, a lot of people reviewing books. But within the profession, we do that as well. And so the books that are coming out are all reviewed. And then we have peer review journals that we look through. And if they're getting good reviews, then we consider them for our collection. And we have, you know, of course, you're limited by how much budget you have. You can't buy every single thing. But we're looking for the really good stuff. We're looking for continuation of series that we already have. And we're looking for popularity. I mean, we don't make a value judgment on, you know, the Daniel Steeles or the James Pattersons. People want to read them, then, you know, we get them. So, you know, it's all, you know, within the restriction of how much money you have to spend overall. And we do monitor collection quite a bit. We look at what people are interested in. We make sure that the nonfiction remains relevant. I mean, we really don't want books about diabetes from 1984 because how you treat diabetes these days is much different. So we have to keep up on that to make sure that our information is still solid information. We don't want to give away something that could be, not good.
Fascinating.
Or damaging. So, yeah, we do all that. And as far as what we call weeding, it's by condition. But we also have the same librarians put together core collection lists. So there's going to be some things that no matter if someone checks them out or not in the last 10 years, they're staying on the shelf. You know, the Shelby Foote books, right? You're not going to get rid of that. But then there's those peripheral things. It's like, it's really not that necessary. It's, you know, fiction that was fun for a while, but it's not lasting literature. So we have to make those kinds of value judgments. But Greg, now that you're in the Racine, you have to know that we have combined our catalog with Racine Public Library's catalog and all the county or the libraries in Walworth County. So we have much more to offer now direct access to, and we'll ship that back and forth. And that of course, also helps us determine what we need to keep on our shelves because, you know, we don't have to keep as many business books, for instance, if we're not really checking out a lot because we can have such easy access to someone else's collection.
Very good. Mm-hmm. What determines how many copies of a given book you order, and what tends to be, you know, sort of the upper echelon of the number of books you would order for the latest Harry Potter book or something else?
Yeah.
That's a big title.
Well, yeah, we'll look at how many have gone out in the past. Of course, when it's something like a new Harry Potter title, we might get 50 of those at once. But we do have the option to rent books for as long as they're of interest, and then we can return them, so we don't need 50 on this shelf.
Interesting.
Anymore.
And who do you rent books from?
Oh, there's a couple companies that will do that.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, it's been for a long, long time.
So you don't end up with 50 copies of Harry Potter number 6 for the rest of the public library's existence.
Yeah, and you get your money back, at least some of your money back. You know, it's a rental.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Other than that, you actually tell us how many to buy by how many titles have been put on hold. So we put a record in the catalog when it's on order already. And then if 50 people have it on hold, we calculate how long we hope you have to wait. And we try to make sure that for every 3 holds, we have 1 copy. So we that's our ratio.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we hear about is how things like compact discs and DVDs and so on are receding from the marketplace. That is, there's not nearly the ferocious market for those kind of items as there once were. Do you see a comparable sort of drop in terms of patrons of the library checking out things like DVDs and videotapes and those kind of matters that you have in your collection, or has that remained relatively steady?
Now, people have gotten used to the whole Netflix model. Those services have been so easy that they're on board with that. So our electronic downloads increased 20% a year. They're just really, really are shifting over to that. And we're so grateful because the CD and the DVD are very tender. And, you know, it's very difficult to loan that kind of material and not have a lot of damage. So it's just so much work to make sure that those are clean and in good condition all the time. So we really are looking forward to the day when everything is downloadable in audio and video.
And are you saying that people can download things via the library?
Oh,
you don't
absolutely.
You don't just mean on their own Netflix account that they have.
No, it isn't through Netflix, but we have our own We have our own, we have Hoopla, which is incredibly popular. There's no waiting list, so you can download your ebooks, you can download TV shows, and you can watch them streaming, which people love.
Wow.
Yeah, people are really into that. I always find it fascinating to travel, because that's when you know the book is in debt. There's plenty of people with books in their hands, right, when you're on an airplane, for instance. But you'll see a lot of streaming video and things like that, too, so it's really kind of the trend watching, where you see what are people really into, and the library is offering all of that stuff.
Fantastic. Back to books for a moment. One of the things that impressed me very much as I looked over your website and your Facebook page was the plethora of different book clubs that operate under the auspices of the Kenosha Public Library. Just give our listeners a sense of just the scope of what I'm talking about here.
Well, it's interesting. Well, you know, we've always had book clubs. And so we have the classics book club, and we have, you know, sci-fi and romance and those kinds of things. But the community has always had book clubs, too. And every community that I've worked in has been like this, where you know there's a lot of book clubs, but and they might get their copies from the library, because we have book club bags where we have 10 copies and then like a guide to the book kind of thing in a bag. So the organizer, you know, can just check the next book out and just distribute them. That makes it easy for them. Now they're starting to interact with the library and saying, I want to run a book club at the library. So we have two in particular. One's military history and politics. And that's really well attended. And of course, in this day and age, it's very well attended. But I find that that's just fascinating, that people come forth from the community and say, I want to lead a book club and I want to do it at the library. And then there's another one called Social Issues Book Club. I think we're calling it Social Justice Book Club. And that came from a woman from the community who said, I just really want to pick books and read them together and discuss these, you know, issues of our day. And it was so popular that we had to divide it into two different sessions. So, I think it's fun that people from the community are coming forward and saying, how about this subject? How about that subject? And now it's that nonfiction subject. It isn't just fiction.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, for someone who reads as voraciously as I do, not only for this job where I'm interviewing several authors a week at least, but also I read plenty on my own. But that's actually something I've never experienced directly, mm-hmm. being in a book club. Mm-hmm. I've never even sat in on one for, you know, a minute or two. Mm-hmm. So I really don't know what goes on in a book club, except that there's all kinds of people who love it, and it's a tremendously important part of their lives. Mm-hmm. Is it as simple as some people sitting around in a circle discussing a book?
It can be. It can be that you can use, you know, pointed questions about what did, you know, the protagonist really want to do, and what was the author's point in writing this book. Well, you could do that. And sometimes there's book clubs where everybody just comes together and they haven't even read the same book. They just want to share what they have been reading, and they kind of go around the circle. There's book clubs where you knit at the same time. Mm-hmm. There's actually book clubs where you come together and you just listen to a book together.
Huh.
It's that thing of coming around together around something you love, right? It's that human story again, being together and talking about things that you like.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. You also, beyond all these different wonderful book clubs that operate under your auspices, you also have a fair number of speakers and presentations. Tell us about that facet of what the library does.
Well, it's the cultural programming, and that's something you just have to, you know, for someone who's worked in so many different places, that it's something you sort of have to figure out with the community about what the need is. If you have a lot of that stuff going on, you really don't invest so heavily as, you know, you're trying to figure out where your niche is. So take a look at the museum. They have some really interesting programs going on. We partner with them now. You know, I know that you've probably heard that the Kevin Levine is coming about the, you know, Civil War monuments. So the you know, the museum reaches out to us and says, let's partner on that. You know, and it's what's of interest. What's the hot topic right now? It's just something that we're trying to grow. Because people do want to come around and together and talk to each other. And we realize the importance of that, that we are these community centers, trusted places where people can come and talk about ideas. And it's something that, you know, it may look like we've got a lot going on, but that's really an area that we're going to really focus on in the next few years. The American Library Association is really behind this and has been for a number of years, teaching us how to bring the community together and have them talk to each other. And I think a lot of people are talking right now about this divide in America and how the library can be such a wonderful catalyst for getting people back together face-to-face and talking through their differences.
Mm.
And I really love that role, and we're going to invest in that role going forward.
Yeah. And it seems to me that one advantage that the library has is that, at least to a large extent, I don't think the public library system, at least generally speaking, bears some of the baggage that other institutions do, where a certain block of the population might make some really simplistic assumptions about, I mean, like this college over here, they're all liberals, or this church over here, they're all conservatives or whatever. And the library seems like one of the last places where you don't make those kind of assumptions. The library is sort of like the airport. It's a place where everybody goes. And so it does not, in a sense, bear the stigma of leaning this way or leaning that way. I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but don't you think there's some truth to what I'm saying?
We think about that every day, and we make a conscious effort to remain neutral. For instance, when people want to partner with us about particular programs, we ask ourselves, do we want to put our name on that? Mm. Who is that speaker? Do they have a bias? Is someone coming in and talking generally, like Kevin Levine? You know, he's been teaching for a long time. How do you teach about these Confederate monuments? Because people look at these things different. Yes, it is part of history, but it's also very offensive to a large group of people because they view that as the relic of slavery. So how do you teach about that? So you look into someone like this and say, you know, what bias are they bringing to this? Are they open-minded? Are they going to convene a conversation where all viewpoints are welcome? That's what we're looking for. So it is a conscious thing. We all have our own biases coming to work, right? And we have to be very careful about keeping the collection neutral. There are books that we buy that I know we have to grit our teeth and buy them, but it's a point of view that we don't agree with, but it's a valid point of view because the author has credentials to back up what they're saying.
Right.
And you know, so they have authority in that area.
Sure.
You know, so we try to remain neutral by collecting all ideas and all points of view, which is sometimes very difficult to do, but that is our something that it's kind of like that oath that doctors take. It's kind
right.
of our oath. We have. That's what we believe in doing.
Sure. So in other words, then, when we go to the shelf at the Kenosha Public Library, we will see Donald Trump's book, and we'll see former President Barack Obama's book.
That's right.
And we'll see Al Franken, and we'll see Rush Limbaugh, and so on.
Yes.
I assume that there are certain lines the Kenosha Public Library would not cross, where something is such a violation of maybe just core human values that a book like that just does not belong on the shelf. I would assume that there are lines that you would not cross.
There are, but I haven't run into very many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It used to be that if you were self-published, that meant that, you know, it was the stuff was no good. That's been a challenge to us, too. Because who's reviewing those?
Mm.
Yeah. But, you know, people can challenge what's in our collection. And first thing we'll say is, what were the reviews, you know?
Mm.
So if it was well reviewed by a source that we trust, then that's a reason to purchase, you know?
One facet of just human life, especially here in America, I shouldn't even say that, all over the world, but I know I live in America, so I know it's really true here, is that the way people secure information is so vastly different. And now when you have a question about when did the Mary Tyler Moore Show begin airing, or something more significant, like when was the first H-bomb test, you go to this thing called Google and you type in your question and there's your answer, and just like that. In a world where that is possible, and not only possible, but just a part of just about everybody's everyday lives, how does that change the mission of the library, which once upon a time was a place you went to find answers to questions or to research a topic and so on? Has that mission either gone away or been greatly diminished or maybe changed in its tenor?
It has. I remember as a reference librarian back in the early 90s, where companies would call us and say, can you list, will you provide me a list of all the companies that make this particular size of brass screw? And we would go to the Thomas Register, which is this, like, I can't remember, how 50 volumes, and we, you know, try to figure this out. And we would write down the names and addresses of all these businesses, and we would call them back. And you know, that was that level of stuff that, you do laugh about it, because, gosh, you can find that, what, you know, in a heartbeat now by yourself. But don't forget, you know, we learned all of those skills of how to find it, and that's really where we're landing now, is teaching that. And we also do that deeper research, things like genealogy, showing you the direction of, you know, and helping you understand the, there's still that pattern of, how am I going to do this research? Step one, step two, step three. You know, one path leads to another kind of thing. And that whole hyperlinked, there's a hyperlinked world out there. Clearly, everybody understands that. You're reading an article, you click off the hyperlink, and you go to something else. Putting everything into context is still, I think, the most important thing that we can do. Hmm. And at this point, I think programming is the best way to do that. Again, back to that history major I was talking about. History puts things into context. Why are we acting the way we do? Why are we making the same mistakes? You know?
I always have to ask a librarian this, and the librarians I interview multiple times probably get very weary of this question. How much do you miss the old card catalogs? I mean, and do you feel like, for all the wonders that are capable as one looks things up on a computer screen, are there things about that that are actually a diminished experience versus that old card catalog where we were flipping through those paper cards?
I've heard people say recently that what was so great about the card catalog is you could see what was next to the other thing.
Yes.
Was that you who said that?
Could be. I mean, I believe that fervently.
It was. You were talking to Nancy Pearl.
Oh,
and
yes.
And you said that.
Yeah, no, it's true.
So I'm quoting you.
Or one of us did, yes, on that recent morning show. Yeah, I feel like, you know, that's the world that we have created now, in which you can go after stuff with such specificity, such focus, leaves all this other stuff out of your path that can be so interesting and lead you into something else. And that's one thing I regret about not being able to flip through those drawers of those cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the other things closely related to that single book that you might be searching for.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I don't miss it at all. You know, honestly, because, you know, I know what kind of work was behind that.
Well, right. That's one thing Nancy Pearl said, too, is it's easy to pine for the days of the card catalog when you weren't the one who had to prepare all those cards.
You
type them and keep them in order. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very, very good point. So, you know, I was thinking, as I talked with you, I'm remembering a story now that I haven't thought of in decades. But when I was in graduate school in Lincoln, Nebraska, as wonderful as the university library was, I spent even more time in the public library downtown. It was a wonderful library, and they had a beautiful music collection in particular that I loved to spend time in there. And I remember one time being in there, and the librarian there never seemed to have too much to do. I mean, it wasn't heavily visited compared to other parts of the library, but every so often she would appear to be busy with something. And I remember one time the phone rang, and she put them on hold and went to the shelves and then came back and went back to whoever this caller was and said, okay, yes, I have that information for you now, and then began On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me, and you know, she was a very, forgive me, but you know, kind of the typical librarian. I mean, kind of bookish and serious and wearing glasses and so on. But you know, reading off the lyrics of the 12 Days of Christmas, and I remember thinking to myself at the time, never in a million years do I want to be a librarian if that's what it means that, you know, when the phone rings, you have to read song lyrics for a Christmas carol to somebody. And now I think about that. That story in a completely different context, given all that we've talked about, the fact that that's exactly why we have libraries. Not for what the things that I think are important, but for the things that somebody else thinks are important, or the question that somebody else has for who knows what reason. And in a sense, there is something so selfless and so generous about why a library exists and the work that you do. You are, in a sense, at people's beck and call for whatever they need in a wide expanse of possibilities. I suspect most people don't really stop to think about that, but that's a reality that you experience, I should think, all the time.
Well, it's the democratization that really appeals to me. It's that social thing behind libraries that keeps me so enamored with my profession, because it's exactly what you said, but broader than that, it's for anyone. Philadelphia is right now putting a tremendous amount of money into libraries and parks, because the statement from the foundations behind that money is that they're the last two places where anyone can go, that the last two bastions of democracy, basically. You don't have to have money. You don't have to have power. You don't have to have education. You're welcome there. And yeah, they're heavily investing in their libraries, which of course pleases me very much. But that recognition, and sometimes that can be uncomfortable to people who visit, that just about every walk of life is there.
Sure.
I don't know if you've been to our libraries lately, but we have signs that say, you are welcome here. And it has pictures of people from every walk of life. And we mean that. That's what the library is intended to be for everyone.
Right. So whether you are the wife of a CEO or somebody many rungs down from that in terms of what we think of as our social hierarchy, there is a place for everybody at the library, and you might be side by side with someone who comes from a very, very different life than your own.
Exactly.
Say a word, if you would, please, about the Kenosha Public Library Foundation and the difference that they make for the well-being of the libraries here in Kenosha.
Well, the foundation really takes a tax-supported institution and adds a layer of excellence to it. Our taxes provide the basics of library service, but for all the innovative and imaginative and extra things that we can do, it's the our supporting agencies, the Friends of the Library and the Library Foundation. And the Library Foundation goes big. And this gala is just remarkable. I am in awe of the energy and the dedication of these mostly very young people in my eyes who are just and it's, you know, it's not just an average event. It is the event of the year. It is a knockout event. And for them to believe in us this way, these are all volunteers. They're very busy people, but they believe so strongly in what we do. It's just heartwarming.
That's terrific. So, Angie Aker, tell us what people are going to experience on Saturday evening, October 7th, those who are fortunate enough to attend your big gala. What is planned for that night?
We have a lot of great things on the docket. We will have an oral history of the Simmons Library and the library system as well. We will have small plates and desserts from Sazzy Bee. We'll have libations. We'll have we've got fire dancers on the terrace and the lawn. We of course have the awards ceremony as well, and we also will have a silent auction with a lot of really exciting items like passes to Disney World and just all kinds of great things to offer there. Yeah. As well as we'll have a jazz trio as well. It's going to just be a really knockout event for sure.
Yeah.
And it's such a rare opportunity, I think, for people to get to go to an event at the Simmons Library. This doesn't happen. You know, this is, we thought this year as we were brainstorming different things that we could do, like, wow, what a great asset this is and what a great space to be able to do something, especially with all that outdoor terrace space.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely lovely. It's a wonderful idea. Say a word about why you chose to honor Howard and Betsy Brown, although that's not like that's a head scratcher. I mean, that
right.
makes the perfect sense. But I'm curious about the specifics of what guided you and your colleagues to want to honor Betsy and Howard in this way.
Well, I mean, you really can't shake a stick around here without running into somebody who's been positively affected by Howard and Betsy Brown, whether they know it or not. And so we were going through the criteria of, you know, when we give these awards for this ongoing event now, what do we want that criteria to be? We didn't want it to just be money. We didn't want it, you know, we didn't want it to be too prescriptive, but we really wanted it to be, you know, indicative of the amount of support in any way that somebody had given to the library, because it is that great equalizer of society, because it's given opportunities to me and my children, you know, who didn't come from a background of means, you know, these types of things that we look at that that Howard and Betsy Brown have just selflessly dedicated. And what's funny is we chose them. We had sort of made our short list, and the board of the foundation had, you know, voted on this. And we just actually realized, we didn't know this before, but Howard and Betsy Brown were the founders of the Kenosha Public Library Foundation.
Oh, really?
This exists because of them.
Wow.
Yes, and we actually had no idea of that piece of the history when we made the decision.
Interesting.
It's funny how information, you know, travels generationally, and it just didn't make its way to most of us on the board.
Right.
So, yeah, so they have just been tireless. Now, there is this really exciting space that's going into, I believe, the Southwest Library, right, Barb? It's called the tween space is what we're calling it now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had noticed that there was kind of a section for the young adults and the high schoolers, and there was a section for the smaller elementary age children. They had these great STEM programs that they were running for kids from, you know, around 10 to 14-ish, and they didn't really have a great dedicated space for them to be working from. Hmm. And so they took a look and kind of inventoried like that space in the library and found this really great space. And so the foundation is using that Howard and Betsy Brown Innovation Fund to create that space for the tweens to be able to do that work from. And so it's just really great timing to be able to do that and honor Howard and Betsy Brown at the same time.
It's all perfect. And of course, yes, it's couldn't be more appropriate to begin this new tradition with these two remarkable people who had so much to do with creating the Kenosha Public Library Foundation and for doing such good work in this community over the years. So if people are interested in attending the event on Saturday, October 7th, what do they need to do in order to purchase their tickets?
Sure. There are a couple of ways that they can get tickets. They can stop into the Library Administration Building Monday through Friday from 8 to 4:30. That's down on 56th Street, 812 56th Street. They can also call that office as well, the Library Administration, and reserve their tickets over the phone. Or else they can also buy them online. They can go to bit.ly/KPLF Gala and buy their tickets right online. They're $75. It's a great evening of just, it's jam-packed in those 2.5-3 hours with lots of fun and events and lots of fellowship.
Right. And of course, every purchase is supporting the Kenosha Public Library Foundation, which in turn supports the Kenosha Public Library.
Absolutely.
And all the great things. You better say that website address one more time.
Absolutely. That's bit.ly/KPLF Gala.
All right. Well, I'm so glad that we had this conversation today, and we trust that a lot of people will seek out the opportunity to support the Kenosha Library and its foundation in this sparkling gala event on Saturday evening, October 7th, which will be at the Simmons Library right in the heart of downtown Kenosha. Barbara Bratton is the director of the Kenosha Public Libraries. Angie Aker, vice president of the Kenosha Public Library Foundation. My deep thanks to both of you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you so much, Craig.
And tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to sharing with you my interview with Martha Breckenbrough, who is the author of a very interesting new biography of Alexander Hamilton called Alexander Hamilton.